Hey, podcasters, we're up in New York City, so we have some great guests for you today. We're also going to tell you about the Russian submarine that the news is full of disinformation right now. Not misinformation, disinformation, because I believe the Soviets do not want the Soviets. Well, the same thing. The Russians don't want you to know what they were really doing. And it all revolves around the statement from Vladimir Putin a couple of summers ago. The world is already in World War III. It's going to be fought with ones and zeros, and the West just won't recognize it yet. Also, the lies and the ties that are being cut to Jeffrey Epstein. Amazing what's happening even online. Digital erasing of facts. And Michael Rechtenwald joins us talking about a digital gulag. It's the left and Google and companies like that and what they're really building for the future. Also, Ami Horowitz, an extraordinarily brave man who is Jewish. He went to Istanbul, he went to Egypt, and also here in the United States to find out exactly what they really believe. It's a dicey roller coaster of a show today. You don't want to miss a second of it on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
First, I want to tell you about one of the largest real estate title companies suffered a breach, nearly 900 million homeowner files. That may mean your home's title, mortgage, bank loan, and all your personal information is in the hands of identity thieves. And they'll forge your title so it looks like you sold it, so they can go to another bank and say, yeah, this is my title, and I've got so much equity in the house, and I want to borrow against that. And so the banks will do it because they're the owner according to the title, and the title is legitimately transferred, and you don't find out until it's too late. Get 60 days risk-free of protection right now at HomeTitleLock.com. Just go to HomeTitleLock.com, HomeTitleLock.com. No obligation. Just see if this has already happened to your home and get protection. In New York, the FBI is saying it's an epidemic. It's HomeTitleLock.com. So let me tell you now, last week, Vladimir Putin abruptly canceled an appearance in Russia to attend an emergency meeting with his defense minister. Now, they said at the same time, Vice President Pence was recalled back to the White House. And the F-22 Raptors arrived to the Gulf at the same time. And then the EU Security Council, like the Russians, called an emergency meeting. Okay, so let me give you a fact check just on that. No, Pence was recalled to the White House for an undisclosed non-national security-related issue. The F-22s had been ordered to the Middle East a long time ago. And the surprise EU Security Council meeting? Well, some of the blue check marks on Twitter should probably do a little homework, because the EU doesn't have a Security Council, so there couldn't be an emergency meeting. Now, there is something that did happen. The real thing that was going on was the emergency meeting with the Russian president. It was called for Putin and his defense minister. But without all these events going on, this single event might not have gotten attention that it ended up receiving. And that would have been a bad thing, quite honestly. I can guarantee you that Putin is pissed that all of those things happened and people were tweeting about it, because globally, attention was turned on a government-run secret military project. That's exactly what we stumbled across last week, and it's important that you understand what happened. This is what we know so far. A Russian nuclear submarine caught fire while operating in the Barents Sea. Now, that's a coast off of northern Russia. The nearest countries are Finland and Switzerland. 14 Russian sailors died trying to extinguish that fire that was reportedly localized in the battery compartment. The sailors were credited by the Russians for preventing, quote, a catastrophe of planetary scale. Now, how is that possible? Well, the first thing we all think of is the word nuclear, submarine, fire. It's another Chernobyl, right? But if you were listening to yesterday's program, you know that most of what HBO showed was hysteria. All right. This is misinformation. This is disinformation. A global catastrophe like Chernobyl is not possible. Now, this is going to sound unsettling, but it's actually not. There are currently 9 nuclear submarines sunk at the bottom of the ocean. There's one right now just off the east coast of Cape Cod. It's been there since 1963. In all, there are 2 U.S. and 7 Soviet or Russian nuclear subs sitting at the ocean floor. So what happens to the reactors? How come the reactors haven't, you know, had the China syndrome? Well, it's the ocean waters, and they're providing a source of infinite cooling, so they'll never explode. So no, the Russian sailors, although very brave and heroic for, you know, perishing to save their ship, did not save the world from a planetary-scale disaster. This, again, is disinformation. It's misdirection. Look over here, look over here. If attention is being diverted intentionally, what's the real story? Attention is being moved through misdirection to get you off of the trail of the Russian submarine. Now, this submarine is very special. It's much smaller than the typical submarine. With its nuclear reactor, it can stay submerged for very long periods of time. It is considered one of the quietest submarines in the Russian fleet, and it was built to go much deeper than any other underwater submersible with 2 separate ship hulls. So in other words, imagine almost like a catamaran. It's got 2 hulls of 2 ships, 2 submarines linked together. Now, why would the Russians want a small nuclear power submarine that can skirt the ocean floor for long periods of time? And why is this project so secret? Well, I think most everybody except this audience is going to be really surprised when the next great war between major powers breaks out. I have talked to you for a long time about being prepared. Being prepared, save food, store water, gas, secure some sort of power source, get off the grid. Why? Because World War III, or the next major war, is going to be unlike anything we've ever fought before. It is cyber warfare. Remember, World War I was unlike any war the world had ever fought before. It was the introduction of tanks. There were, at the end of World War I, there were almost no horses left anywhere in Europe because everybody grabbed their horse and they went to war. Well, a horse isn't going to stand up against a tank, and so most of the horses were slaughtered in Europe. Also, the introduction of chemical warfare and gas warfare that had never been seen before, and it shocked the world. This time, cyber warfare is going to shock the world. And it's going to shock the world because everything is going to change. If you would look at a map of the ocean floor today, it would almost look like a giant circuit board. Underwater communication cables stretch out from New York all the way to Europe, from the West Coast to Asia, and literally everywhere in between. It's how we are so interconnected. It's how you can Skype with someone in Africa or visit a website in Poland. And the underwater circuit board, if you will, began a long, long time ago in 1854 with the installation of the first transatlantic telegraph cable. These communication lines have been laid for decades, and they have been targets for decades. They've been target for spies ever since. Think about it with just the telegraph cable. If you're Germans and you wanted to hear what America and England were talking about in World War I, all you have to do is just tap into the telegraph table, right? Well, that's what this is. During the Cold War, a U.S. submarine, the USS Halibut, successfully located and tapped a Soviet line during Operation Ivy Bells. That is the foreshadowing of what is coming now. Our internet, our interconnected world depends on the flow of ones and zeros. And they are currently racing at the speed of light under our oceans. This Russian submarine was built to take advantage of that. They can locate and attach themselves to these deep cables. They can siphon off all of the information. They can insert malware to attack anything from the electrical grid to the water supply stations to the Defense Department. And when the information has all been stolen and the weapons have all been unleashed, they can sever the cables and leave us in the dark. This is modern day warfare. Deep under the sea, which is as unknown to most people as the dark side of the moon. This will be a first strike weapon. And I don't think we're anywhere close to understanding it as people. I hope our Pentagon is on it. I'm sure they are.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. You know, I was having dinner with some people the other night, and we were talking about, you know, the world and politics and what we think are going to, you know, the future holds. And everybody asked me, so are Texans awake yet on how much money is being poured into Texas to make that a blue state? And I said, no, I don't think they are. Jeez. I think Texans are just like the rest of America was in 2007 and 8, oblivious. And they're just like, oh, no, that'll never happen. Yeah, we can never have those things happen. I don't think they understand how close Texas really is to being a blue state. It's very purple right now.
Do you think so? Because I'm not sure about that. I keep hearing Texas is
really?
Blue. Texas is turning blue. It's a battleground state. If you look back at the Beto and Cruz election, you know, the left plays the game really well, where they just keep repeating the same lie until a pretty decent segment of Americans believe them. But just because they say it over and over and over and over again doesn't make it true. I could say monkeys are flying out my butt every day. That doesn't make it true. It's just...
But it is true. That particular, that's a bad example.
That is a bad example.
So wait a minute. Why
if you
do
go
you
back
say
to the
re-election, true?
Go back to the election with Ted and Beto. Ted was re-elected essentially by 51-48, so about 3 points. And the media said, oh, wow, just a 3-point victory in Texas? Well, Texas is in play. We keep trying to tell you. But let's not forget what was going on at the time. For whatever reason, Beto was the darling of and the rock star of the Democrat Party. He'd raised over $80 million, an all-time record for a Senate campaign. The vast majority of that came from out of state. The day after the election, he had about $1.98 left in his account. I mean, he spent every penny pretty much. And he outspent Ted at least 2-1, maybe 3-1, and lost. Even though he had all the momentum, he had an adoring media on his side, locally and nationally, every step of the way. And you add to that the fact that Ted had some, you'd forget sometimes, he had some serious issues at the time. Namely, he had just pissed off all of the Trump supporters because of the rough campaign they had against each other, including the fact that Ted refused to endorse Trump at the GOP convention. Okay, they were really angry about that. So then, what was it? A week and a half later, he turned around and did a 180, which didn't really please the Trump fans because it wasn't at the convention. And now suddenly he just angered his entire base of conservatives. So the Democrats hated his guts from the beginning. And just to tie the other hand behind his back, too, before the election, he alienated everybody who would potentially be on his side in a normal election. But even with all of that, even with all of that, I mean, he had every reason to lose, I think. He had nearly everybody turned on him, and he still won the election. So I'm not sure I believe the Texas is turning blue thing.
So I do, and I do because I've talked to many of the Republican players who, you know, for instance, the governor, who is really paying attention to this, and the money that is being spent in Texas to turn us blue.
Yeah, I do know
and
that.
And it's not only the only the money that's happening. You know, we've had a, what is it, a 48% increase in illegals in Texas over the last couple of years. I mean, it's incredible what's happening to our state. And as always, the progressives take the cities. They have Austin. They have Dallas now. They have Houston. And, you know,
well,
as
they've had the major
metropolitan grow and grow and grow.
They've had the metropolitan areas for quite a while, though. You know, it's always been the suburbs.
Yes, I know. Correct, but you're taking an influx of mass amounts of illegals and mass amounts of Californians are coming in. We're getting 1,000 people a week from California moving into Texas. And that's not counting. That's just the population growth. That's not counting the people who are being affected by the money. I just don't think that Texans are aware of the efforts, and I think people are lulled into this false sense of security of saying Texas will always be, it'll always be red, it'll always be red. I don't think it will be if we don't pay attention to it.
I mean, that part is true, because like the Constitution, it doesn't just protect itself, you know, and Texas
right.
doesn't just protect itself. We have to do the work, both with the Constitution and with Texas. So you're right, we do have to be aware of the efforts. Because they would like nothing. I mean, if they do win Texas, then it's over, right? You will never win another national election.
No. No. You flip Texas.
That's bad.
You flip the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it is truly the line in the sand. And it's interesting because Texas is where that phrase came from. Davy Crockett drawing a line in the sand at the Alamo. Texas is the line in the sand for the Republic. If you lose Texas, you lose the Republic.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. Almost a year ago, I picked up a book called Springtime for Snowflakes. And I read it and I thought, this guy is either a covert op that's making us all think that he is on our side, but he's actually not. Or he's the bravest guy I think I've ever met. And he turns out, I mean, this is what he wants me to believe. He turns out to be a guy who is really, truly brave and honest. And his name is Michael Rechtenwald. And he was a professor at NYU who lost his gig at NYU. It had nothing to do with him taking on the system. They made that very clear, did they not, Michael?
Yes.
You started tweeting.
That's right.
And what were some of your tweets?
Well, I mean, I tweeted things like, you know, social justice warriors. There's a bunch of little Stalins running around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just imagine that. And then wake up and realize, yes, you're in that world. You have a bunch of Stalins running around. They're just Stalin, just weirder. It's SJW. So I was trying to get at the idea, like, right. we were dealing with a bunch of, authoritarians all over the place. And things like that. And I talked about some of the craziness going on campuses, for example. You know, the establishment of segregated dormitories, you know, where they were, African-American-only dorms, you know, like a reversal of things that were supposedly progressive, you know, or moving forward. And the Halloween costume insanity, mm-hmm. where you couldn't dress up as anything, you know, that might be appropriating of some culture. Meanwhile, you have the left dressing up as a new person every day.
Right.
I mean, so they're changing
right.
their identities on the fly.
Right.
But nobody can wear a Halloween costume for
right.
a night.
And you were a guy, you were one of the most popular professors
yeah.
at NYU, which mm-hmm. is not exactly a conservative school.
Mm-mm.
You're not a conservative or weren't a conservative.
Not really, no.
You actually wrote white papers
yeah.
for communists.
For Marxists, yes.
Okay, yeah.
yeah.
And you wrote that. You told me you wrote those things because in theory,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
In theory,
yeah.
communism is great.
Yeah.
But in practice, it never works.
Right. I was with like a group that called themselves left or libertarian communists, and everybody on the other side of the middle thinks that's complete oxymoron, of course.
Right.
But they believe that, like, the workers of their own accord, without, like, the vanguardists or as the leaders, like the Bolsheviks, taking charge, that if it all has spontaneously erupted from the bottom up, then it'll be workers will have, like, control of everything, and mm-hmm. it's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's no greed, there's no evil, there's no bad people amongst the workers. They're
right.
all pure.
They're all pure, yeah.
They're all saints. I mean,
right.
so what it is you're born, whatever, you know, rank and class you're born into in the world, according to the left, that basically sanctifies you, in effect. So that, you know, it's just a very weird theology.
Right. And you were part of it.
Absolutely.
And when you realized that people were serious and they were starting to go for actual communism.
Yeah. Well, actually, when they were starting to go for people's heads, you know, starting to talk and act and attack people in the way that, like, the Red Guard did in
right.
the Cultural Revolution and
right.
Under Maoism from 66 to 76, and just insanity, where they just routed out everything and they started destroying all the cultural artifacts, the historic, anything that represented historical memory, tradition, convention, it had to be razed to the ground. And I saw the same things happening here, like literature being thrown out of the curriculum. You know, of course, we see statues being defaced, all kinds of historical memory being erased. It started to seem like the same.
What was Mao's purpose for doing that?
Well, he was very self-motivated. First of all, he was trying to eliminate any competition that he was having within the mm-hmm. party. So if he got all these Red Guard, and they were all students, very, very, you know, gullible and enthusiastic and mm. crazy. And mm-hmm. he got them like, hey, guess what? You can go in and basically overthrow the classroom. How would you like to go in and kick your teacher out? Or how would you like to put them on trial?
That's happening.
Yeah.
That's happening now in
yeah.
America.
And so he actually turned the populace against the state, against the very social order itself, to dissolve it so that he would have absolute supremacy.
Which, who is the Mao of our time? How is this?
Mm.
How is this happening?
There's a lot of mini Maos. I call them mini Maos. It's like sort of like Minnie Mouse.
Yeah.
Because there's no big figures like this that are able to. I mean, you have the North Korean leader, but I mean
yeah.
that doesn't count. We're talking about, like, in our world, there's a few. People, I mean, there's a lot of people.
So where's it coming from?
It's coming from these people that are tapping into their moral superiority and their authoritarian impulses, and their moral probity. They think they're absolutely right, and they think they have the truth on their side, and they're on the right side of history. This is the key. If you're on the right side of history, because they think history is going in a direction, happens to be the direction they want it to go in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is called Whiggish history, because that's how the Whigs thought in Great Britain. They thought that, you know, there was a progress narrative of history. And, of course, the progress was all going the way that towards their types of policies. And this is the same thing these people hold. They hold this progress narrative. It's all going their way. basically anything new is good, including any new genders, anything. But anything not new is cis or X.
Right.
You know, and just like in the Soviet Union, they started calling, you know, in the, during the Great Terror, anybody that was designated as an XEX, that is your ex-official, ex-this, ex-that from another, from the earlier regime, you were going to the gulag. So I say that cis is kind of like the equivalent of X. It's a way of marking the antiquated who must go down.
How the obvious question here, Michael, how do these people who say they're fighting against authoritarians, how do they not see that they are exactly what they despise?
It's amazing. If I was a cartoonist, I would draw a picture of an Antifa character who's looking in a mirror, and he sees on his forehead a swastika. Okay, but, you know, because they are absolutely replicas of
they
what
are.
They think they're against.
They are the brown shirts or the black shirts.
Yeah, it's very frightening. But what's frightening about it is the unself-consciousness of that. How is the self-delusion so thick that you could actually be the incarnation of what you think you're against?
A lot of people will say that it was people like you work around or may have been on the campuses that are just filling people's heads with gobbledygook.
I can't even tell you. I mean, it's so sad. To me, it's so sad what's happened. I think that, like, for example, what happens to the college curricula, they've turned it into, like, basically it's a moral program based on social justice as the main creed. And they've rid anything that doesn't fit. You know, like, for example, at SOAS in London, it's a university that they threw out all white male philosophers from the philosophy curriculum. Okay?
That's all Western philosophy.
That's everybody.
Yeah, that's
in
everybody.
Fact, there isn't, you know, maybe it leaves Ayn Rand, but, I mean, they're not going to teach her.
No.
So there's not much left. And, you know, whatever reason, still, you know, these are people that contributed a great deal to our society and our culture.
You read Plato today and you can learn a lot.
Oh, yeah, you learn. And I mean, however you want to think about it, you know, there's a great connection between Platonic thinking and Christianity, for example. There's a great deal of connection there, whether you think that, you know, Christianity borrowed from it or it was a precursor that sort of set the stage. You know, it works either way, but it definitely is deeply foundational to the way we are.
So how many people, this is the argument I think people are having in themselves, or unfortunately it's keeping them blind because they think that there's not enough people that actually believe in these things. And so they're going to, you know, this is just going to stop at some point. And you do see evidence that people are waking up because they're pushing way too far.
Right.
But how many people do you think on the campuses, if you look at it, you know, through polls, 70-80% are buying into it?
Yeah. What I heard was at NYU, the students would tell me that the worst places weren't even the classrooms. It was the dormitories where the students were self-patrolling each other in the social justice creed, and they were correcting each other if they, you know, were saying or doing or acting in a wrong way according to the creed. So there was a lot of, like, censorship going on within the dormitories and stuff like that, and, like, a lot of, you know, like, blackballing students. And it was sounded like a horror show. And I was living the worst of it as a professor who's not, you don't get out in 4 years unless they throw you out.
Right.
You know, they only have a short term there. It's not going to last forever. But, you know, I had to live with that. And it's spooky.
So, Michael, I think a lot of people think, where the hell did that come from? Where did that word come from? All of a sudden, you know, the patriarchy is something we're talking about. And we never talked about that before.
Right.
And the patriarchy has no gender. Well, then what is it?
Yeah, they like to keep it nebulous, you know, because then they can move it around and put it on anybody. But yeah, but the patriarchy was supposedly, you know, of course, domination by the patriarchs, by male, you know, authority figures and so forth. And the West does not have a patriarchy. Okay, this is very clear. There are
the
some
Middle East. The Middle does. East has a patriarchy.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. That is a patriarchy. And interestingly enough, the Western feminists have no problem with
the Mid-Eastern patriarchy.
Yes, they don't critique it, and they actually will scold you severely if you talk about the hijab and anything mm-hmm. like that. So mm-hmm. it's a very weird thing. The reason why they keep it this way, like, so the patriarchy has no gender, so that they can paste it on anybody. Particularly what they like to do is people that are supposed to be in a victim class and don't behave properly for that victim class category, they go after those people with more vengeance than they do anyone. And that's the scariest thing. Like this, you know, the president of the Heritage Foundation, African-American woman, Kay Jones, I think it was her last name, but she's she was elected to be on the advisory board of Google, right? And because she is conservative, the Google, what I call them, the Red Guard within the Google woke force, as I put it in the book, they went mad. I mean, and they called her everything from, transphobe and all that to a white supremacist. They went after her with more vehemence than they go after the oppressors. So this just shows me that they're not interested in serving the subordinated. And I'm not saying there aren't subordinated people in this world. What I'm saying is the left uses them. They're just props.
Oh, yeah. Historically speaking,
yeah.
Do we wake up from this before it's too late?
Let's just say this. The waking up is going to be scary for a lot of people, and I think it's going to have to be, like, they're going to be woken up by knocks on the door, in effect, metaphorically, you know, at night. You know, just like when
they start coming for them.
When the Cheka starts coming to your door and hauling you off to the gulag. Not effectively in the exact same way, but the more people that are going to be ripped down, called down, ripped me too'd, whatever.
Right. The people that are right now being, kicked off of Twitter, kicked off of YouTube, Facebook, everything else. They include people like you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they include people who are effective and from, you know, formerly from their group.
Yeah.
When you wake up and come out and go, wait a minute, this is really dangerous, they stifle you. And at some point, I mean, the Niemöller poem is true. At first they came for the trade unionist, and I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't care.
That's right, exactly.
Until they come for you.
You know, I wasn't even talking about my type. I'm talking about, like, African-Americans, like, for example, Candace Owens, who doesn't behave properly according to the victim
class. Kanye West.
Yes. And, even Clarence Thomas. I mean, it just would not conform, and so they, he said, he went through an electronic lynching.
Yeah.
Now it's digital lynching and digital disappearances. Which is really what scares me.
Yeah, the depersonization.
Yes, the depersoning or unpersoning.
Yeah, unpersoning.
Because once everybody is, and first of all, they've made the public sphere basically irrelevant or limited to the digital sphere. So there's nowhere to really get to anybody with any message outside of the digital sphere. Then they have complete control over it, and it's privatized, so there's no state sanctions of anything. There's no rights. And so they're just erasing any opinions that they don't like.
And what's crazy is so many people in Silicon Valley that I've talked to, they all talk about the end of the nation state. They want it.
Definitely.
Because of that,
yes.
There is no constitution. There are no laws. They make the laws, and they'll be able to shape society any way they want.
Yeah.
I'm a capitalist. I've never been, one that jumps on these anti-capitalist, anti-corporate kind of bandwagons. But these corporations are truly becoming frightening.
Yeah.
And they're telling us what they're going to do.
You're listening to the Best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. Ami Horowitz is an American documentary filmmaker. He is writer, producer, and director of Ami on the Streets. He co-wrote, co-directed, and starred in the 2009 documentary UN and Me, an examination, a critical examination of the United Nations. He's done so much since. Is that where we first met, when we first met, Ami?
That is the first time I met.
And I thought you were brave back then. This is one of the craziest things I've ever seen you do. You went undercover. You're kind of a known guy now. You went undercover in the Middle East to talk to members of the Muslim Brotherhood. You pretended to be an anti-Semitic Jew, and they were willing to talk to you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The Muslim Brotherhood is an interesting organization. It depends on who you ask, and different people will tell you different things about them.
Sure.
You ask the left, and it's a benign mm-hmm. Muslim organization mm-hmm. trying to lift Islam, you know, right. out of the muck. And, right. and you ask people on the right, it's a terrorist organization that has an insidious goal. So I wanted to find out what the reality was, because the Muslim Brotherhood is the largest Muslim organization on planet Earth, and it spans across continents. Mm-hmm. And it's heavily involved in the West. And I wanted to get a better sense of what the reality was. And the best way to do it is not reading articles or newspaper interviews, mm-hmm. because it's meaningless. It's all people kind of coming up with conjecture. I wanted to go and meet with them myself, the leadership, the people on the ground. So I traveled to Egypt and Beirut and Istanbul and Germany and here in Southern California and met with these people to find out what the reality was.
And what'd you find?
Not good.
Let me play a clip. Here's a first clip. Sets up the video. Who are the Muslim Brotherhood and what do they want? Here it is.
The Muslim Brotherhood is an organization that began in the 1920s in Egypt as a religious and social organization. It has over the years metastasized to become the largest global Islamic organization in the world, with branches in dozens of countries. It has representatives in various governments and leadership in social and charitable organizations around the world. Its stated goals are to spread Islam and the word of the Quran throughout the world, with the ultimate objective being the creation of a global caliphate.
Now, did they use the word global caliphate?
Yes. Yes. No, there's no question that they are looking, and anybody who knows the Muslim Brotherhood at all, anyone who's intellectually honest, I should say, know that that is one of their major goals, is sure. to create a global caliphate, because they think that Islam, in their slogan is Islam is the constitution, jihad is the only way, and death in the way of Muhammad is the ultimate result. So this is it's in their slogan.
Right. You would think you'd have a hard time, at least in the West, you know, getting people to join up if that was your slogan for your country club.
Not the most attractive slogan I've ever heard.
Not
in my
one
life.
That you're really interested in. It's amazing to me, Ami, on how much I was mocked for caliphate, and yet that is so clearly the stated goal of anybody who is an Islamist.
Yes. I think that's true, and it's particularly true with the Muslim Brotherhood. It's part of what it is in their DNA.
Right.
To do that. And to affect that goal. What they have done, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, okay? But I have to say that when people say they're sending, I don't know what word you want to use, agents, representatives, use whatever adjective you want. Mm-hmm. There's no question they're doing that. I've met with these quote-unquote representatives, agents, who were placed in the United States and in Europe, and they were telling us, our goal is to undermine, this is on camera, undermine the United States. And by the way, one of the ways they do that, I find it fascinating, is that they have created alliances with the left. This one guy I met, Mohammed Sakhar, who, by the way, who's living in Southern California, mm-hmm. openly, has called, by the way, for the death of an assassination of our president, and is accused of murdering a policeman in Egypt, which is why he came to, and he ran to the United States. I don't know why he's still living here in a condo near the beach, you know, in Manhattan Beach, which I love. But he was very clear in saying, yeah, I work very closely with the left because if they don't agree with our goals, they certainly, you know how the left works in terms of mm-hmm. its notion of equality, and they mm-hmm. see Islam as kind of being an oppressed, you know, case. Mm-hmm. So they try to to work with them. So he not only works with the left, he has called openly for the destruction of the United States, did so on camera with me, and said, look, if I'm killed, you know, I die for this goal, I will die a happy man, which I don't know, sounds pretty insidious when somebody who's Islamic says, I'm willing to die for my goal. You know.
So is this Nidal Sakhar?
Yes.
Okay, so we have a cut of this. Here's clip two. Listen.
The way Muslim Brotherhood exists and operates is the following. They do have those general guidelines and approach and school of thought. However, each chapter deals with its own realities and challenges and very specific circumstances. Like, for example, in the U.S., it's different than, for example, the U.K. or France or some other places. So you operate from within, like, the environment that you're in a way that's most fit.
You work from within the system.
From within
to
the system.
To rise up.
From within the system.
How successful is that approach right now?
It's very, very successful.
So, now, you're not, this is not a hidden camera.
No, no.
Why are they speaking to you?
It's amazing to me how open they are once the camera, in general, I find it odd that people become very honest when the camera's rolling. You think it'd be the opposite, but in my experience interviewing people who are bad dudes,
right,
they tend to get very open because I think what it comes down to is he doesn't think what he's saying is a problem. You know, and you didn't roll the part where he's talking about the structure of the United States and his willingness to die for that goal. But you would think that's something you would really want to hide from the public. Mm-hmm. But the truth is he feels that this is a good. This is a positive. So he wants to get that word out there. And very few people can, A, find the guy and, B, are willing to interview him. Right? You don't see him on CNN or, right, or on these other channels. But I found him, so he was able to speak to me. They're shockingly open.
So when he talks about infiltrating the government, for instance, I don't have the proof, but we have a lot of connective tissue for Ilhan Omar to CARE. And CARE is a sister organization of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's CARE is a front organization to help with its to help with its image and popularity and to raise funds for Hamas. That's what it was founded to do. Ilhan Omar, it doesn't make sense to me that she's involved with the Muslim Brotherhood and CARE when the real face of the Muslim Brotherhood is women don't have a voice. There are no equal rights. There's certainly no gay rights. And she stands for all of these things. And no one seems to ever have a problem in CARE, et cetera, with what she says.
I mean, first of all, when you talk about, and we're going to have a whole different tangent, which I'd rather not, I want to stick to your question. But when you talk about the how antithetical you would think, the values of radical Islam are to the left, you still have this alliance to the left, even though you would think that right. Why would the left want to work with groups of people who are against all those issues?
Right, but flip it the other way. Why would the Muslim Brotherhood want to work with the left if they didn't think in the end they're going to win and we'll just take care of those people later?
Well, that's the answer. They're useful idiots. And,
right.
And it's a term
right.
You like to use, and it's true.
Right.
They're useful idiots for these people. But when it comes to CARE and these other, like, so you have a number of these organizations which cut across the United States. There are Islamic organizations that kind of encompass a lot of the Islamic community in the United States, and CARE being the most significant one of them. CARE, some people don't know, was an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation, which was the Muslim Brotherhood was directly sending funds to Hamas. Is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. It is part of the Muslim Brotherhood, and people in the United, major Islamic leaders here in the U.S. were funding Hamas through this group called the Holy Land Foundation, and CARE, and actually all the major Islamic organizations were all unindicted co-conspirators. Now, if you ask CARE today, are you connected to the Muslim Brotherhood? They will say, no, we're not connected. Now, the truth is, it was started by Muslim Brotherhood members. That's not in dispute.
Right.
And they oftentimes will have conferences bringing Muslim Brotherhood leaders to these conferences.
Correct.
So they can speak to their ideology. So the question has to become, what does that mean you're not connected to them? Ilhan Omar, look, I don't think we have to connect Ilhan Omar to anything to show that she hates America.
Mm-hmm.
She's an open anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. I think she makes that connection herself when she opens her mouth. Mm-hmm. We don't have to try to draw dots between her and other organizations. She clearly holds those ideologies.
But is that what he was talking to you about when he said we infiltrate governments? We go into these countries and we infiltrate the government. Is it at that level that they are working with congressmen, senators? I mean, what level does he mean?
Yeah, no, they absolutely lobby in Congress, and they try to support candidates that they support. Now, that's not to say, again, I don't want to make it seem like the Muslim Brothers is a super powerful organization in the United States. That's kind of, you know, they don't have that kind of power at all. Now, they have had a number of successes, and the Women's March is a perfect example, where the Women's March had a lot of connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. They've had successes, but they are not this uber organization that really controls all the strings in government. That's not really what the reality is.
Okay. Let me play the next clip. This one is where you ask him if the Muslim Brotherhood is allied with the American left. Listen.
How closely the Brotherhood working with the leftist and liberal organizations?
They're my backers and they're my defenders in political circles.
So the left really, you have an alliance with the left in the United States?
The left would be natural ally, of course. They were our backers and supporters and actually coalition partners. I mean, now Republican Party actually is basically Hell Hitler kind of party, you know. It's even worse than the Jewish pro-Israeli in some ways.
So the Republicans are Nazis. And worse than the pro-Israel lobby.
The Jewish pro-Israel lobby. Wow. You have to throw the Jewish word, the Jews in there. The Jews.
Wow.
Yeah, this is what it's become. But again, if you ask the people on the left, do you have a problem with the Muslim Brotherhood? They'll say no. Of course. First of all, they don't know anything. They're a bunch of fools.
Yeah, yeah.
But they'll say no, of course not. Absolutely not. Listen, Linda Sarsour, we show a clip of her there. Linda Sarsour, I'm not saying she's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. I don't know if she is. Her uncle is a Muslim Brotherhood leader here in the United States, and I've spoken to him. But she clearly is part of the connective tissue that we're kind of talking about when it comes to radical Islam and the left kind of working together. She's almost emblematic of that.
Yeah.
She is. She's a touchstone. She's an ideological leader of the left, despite the fact that she's an anti-Semite, anti-Israel, and in my view, anti-American.
So how can she wear the Islamic garb and be so devout on Islam and not be a pariah in her own community?
What do you mean? That's one of the reasons why she's lauded, is because she's brave enough to wear the hijab.
But
she's so brave, but
she's also going against all traditional norms for Islam. She is for women's. She's outspoken on women's rights.
Oh, you mean the
rights.
way she's looked on by Islam, not by the left?
Yeah, by Islam. I just know enough people that have been targeted by Islam that these people like Rashid or Omar, they're all saying the same things that people. On the anti-Islam Islamist side would say about their culture. These people are all for it. Gays were gay rights, women's rights, etc., etc., and they're embraced. So how do you explain that other than they're not telling the truth and the Islamists know it?
Well, that would be an explanation, wouldn't it?
It sure would be. I'll give you a second to see if you can come up with another explanation.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.